All right, I want to welcome everyone to the final session, which is going to be a panel discussion for these, for us few diehards, us dedicated ones. And the topic of this panel discussion, I think, is meant to be something like prospects for the future or some kind of something. We've heard a lot of interesting talks, both on the theory side and the observational side at this meeting. But of course, we don't know everything yet. And that's what we're going to be talking about in this discussion, sort of what we don't know and how we might go about knowing it, both from an observational and a theoretical viewpoint. And the way I've decided to structure this discussion is I'm going to make a very brief presentation presenting a few broad categories of topics that I think are relevant to the meeting. Remember, the meeting was about the interactions between galaxies and the IGM. I'll make this brief presentation. I'll go back to the beginning, and we'll discuss each broad topic one at a time. I'll start the discussion always with our panelists. If they have any comments to say on that topic, they were given the questions in advance, unlike the presidential candidates. And then we'll open up the discussion to the whole audience, and then when we get bored with that topic, we'll move on to the next one. I selected the panel. We have Len Cowie representing the high redshift universe. Observationally, Richard Machassi representing the X-rays and other non-galaxy issues. Representing simulations, we have Volker Springel. Representing theory old school, the old-fashioned way, Avishai Dekel. That's a compliment, not a derogatory statement. And Crystal Martin representing the winds. So that's sort of the prelim here. Let me just quickly go through sort of how I sort of view some of the broad questions. This is my first PowerPoint ever, so bear with me. Not that I made it. All thanks to Ramil for coming in. There we go. So the first thing I want to talk about is how do galaxies grow? I mean, at this conference, which is the interaction between galaxies and the IGM, we've been sort of concentrating more how the galaxies are affecting the IGM. But of course, this is a two-way street. I mean, equally important to me, and even more important, because it sort of, before you can have the galaxies affect the IGM, you better have the IGM affect the galaxies, and the way that's where all the mass that you're going to make your galaxy out of is coming from. And how is that material getting from the IGM into your galaxy? So even though we didn't discuss it much, I want to have that be part of our discussion here. And the first issue that I want to just mention is, right, there's two ways that galaxies can accrete their material. One is through merging with other galaxies, right? Which is often the thing that's sort of stressed in a lot of these hierarchical galaxy formation models. But of course, you can also have cooling flow type things, which is also stressed, talked about in these models, but not always at the same time. And what is the relative importance of those two processes? And one thing I can tell you is that in our simulations, it is this smooth accretion that dominates the fuel, if you will, the gas that's coming into the galaxies. And that's just being plotted here. Here's time going forward, or redshift on the top. This is just the amount of accretion averaged over all galaxies in units, solar masses per cubic megaparsec per year. Just as a reference, the dotted green line, that's just the star formation rate, the cosmic star formation history. You can see this purple line is the smooth accretion, stuff that's coming into galaxies for the first time, if you will, hasn't been in a galaxy before. And this is the stuff entering galaxies through mergers. And you can see this line actually includes stars and gas, so it's a bit of a cheat. The gas one would be actually lower, which is why they appear not to be adding up to the overall number. But you can see, at least in the simulations, it's the smooth accretion that's dominating over the merging. Now, is there some way maybe we can address this or test this observationally in the future? Oh, another related issue to this, of course, is when people are making models of galaxy formation, how is the star formation being triggered? Is it just basically a supply-side problem? Is it just, you know, as you get fuel to come in, that's sort of basically setting your star formation rate like we find in the simulation? Or is it one of these more semi-analytic ideas where it's triggered by some kind of mergers and most of the star formation you're seeing is actually some kind of triggered event? The next thing I want to talk about is the smooth accretion. How, as Avishai mentioned in his talk, it appears in the simulations in his work, his analytic work, that the smooth accretion isn't as simple as we once thought. That perhaps there's a hot mode and a cold mode of accretion. One mode, the hot mode, the standard mode we all learned about, where you have some kind of accretion shock near the virial radius, you heat up to the virial temperature, and then the accretion rate is basically determined by cooling times. Or this other mode, this cold mode, where the gas never heats up at all. And that's shown here. Here, at different redshifts in the simulation, is the maximum temperature the gas has reached at any time previous to when it accreted onto the galaxy. So that's what's being plotted here. So you see, like at redshift 5, none of the gas that accreted onto galaxies at redshift 5 ever reached a temperature more than 10 to the 4 degrees. So at some intermediate redshift, like redshift 2, it's more bimodal. Right, that half has been roughly in this cold mode, you know, never above the virial temperature, near the virial temperatures. And then there's this peak of hot gas that's somewhere around the virial temperatures of structures. And then as you go to low redshift, it gets harder and harder to separate, but there's probably more hot mode than there is cold mode. But the other thing to notice, if you look at the blue plots, which is the actual numbers, the scales are all the same, you see that the overall accretion rate is dropping as well. So you have two effects. You have this change from hot mode, from cold mode dominated to hot mode dominated, and the overall accretion in the universe is all dropping. And one thing I just want to mention is that in the same size halo, if you have to allow the gas to cool, it's 2.5 to 5 times less efficient of a way of getting gas into the galaxy than this cold mode method. And as Avichai also pointed out, you can it's not all or nothing. You can get simultaneous hot and cold mode sometimes. Here, this is just the fraction in cold or the fraction in hot as a function of the halo mass. And if you look at redshift 0 here, you can see there's a mass switch. The big mass halos are the hot mode dominated the way you normally think, and the small halos are cold mode dominated. And at high redshifts here, you can see that even in the big halos, there's still substantial amounts of cold mode going on even while you have the hot mode going on. But I think the most interesting fact, and how it relates to all the subjects we've been talking about, is that the cold mode and hot mode are very geometrically distinct processes. Here, plotted at redshift 5.5 and redshift 3.2 are the same halo in our simulation, just at these different times. It's devolved. At redshift 5.5, it's below this magic halo mass where it's cold mode dominated. And at redshift 3.2, it's now gotten more massive. It's now hot mode dominated. And you can see here in this density plot, for example, so the stuff plotted in green, by the way, is all, in this case, is all the stuff that's going to accrete by redshift 5. And in this case, all the stuff that's going to accrete by redshift 3. So you can see when it's cold mode dominated, it's very filamentary. And all the accretion's coming down these filaments from quite a large distance compared to, in this case, it's all in the center. It's a standard hot mode type accretion. And you can look here in the temperature plot here, same kind of thing. See, here you have a hot halo of gas when it's hot mode dominated surrounding the galaxy. But when it's cold mode dominated and everything's coming down the filaments and nothing ever heats up and you have no accretion shock, there is no hot halo of gas. There's no gas there. All right. And finally, the hot mode itself, this classic hot mode, which was the thing we've all learned about, do we really understand even that process that we've always assumed that we understood? Right, the standard way we've thought about it, which is now the basis of all these semi-analytic galaxy formation calculations, goes back to Frank and White. I forget if it was White and Frank. I forget the ordering. Anyway, from 91, where you just make this assumption that you have, you know, this heats up to the virial temperature, the density distribution matches roughly that of the dark matter. You cool inside out in sort of a smoothly averaged way, and that tells you your accretion rate. But this paper that appeared over the summer by Mahler and Bullock questions even that idea. Perhaps the cooling doesn't proceed in that way. In this paper, they had this idea that you have local thermal instabilities, that a lot of the material goes into these little lumps, basically, that then lower the density of the rest of the gas that can no longer really cool so efficiently. And those lumps can stay around for quite some time without ever accreting on the galaxy. They might bump into each other, and then that might cause the gas to accrete. But anyway, the whole process is much different than we've been assuming. And there's been other contentions as well that maybe conduction limits this process of just the standard cooling. And of course, this all relates to cluster cooling flows as well, because big galaxies are just You know, there's some continuum between you go from big galaxies up to the centers of galaxy clusters. So it's not even clear we understand how the hot mode accretion works. So that's one broad topic that I spent a little more time on than the others, just because we didn't talk about that at this meeting. The other ones I'll be a little quicker on. So we've talked about the effects of feedback on galaxies. Right? We talked about the effects of feedback, which we'll get to in a second, on the IGM. There's also the effect of feedback on galaxies. How do they affect themselves with their feedback? And I split the feedback into three separate categories, even though it's usually all lumped into one. The first broad kind is the kind of feedback, this is the kind that Simon was talking about, but, and that was the kind that was originally first proposed when people were talking about galaxy formation, and that's the kind of feedback that prevents the gas from getting into the galaxy in the first place. So the gas never gets in. Now this is clearly going to depend on the geometry, right? If you're in that cold mode case and there's filaments, it's going to be really hard to stop the gas from coming in. But if you're sort of spherically symmetric, it's got to be easier. What's the source of this prevention? Is it AGN? Is it supernova? Is it something else? I don't know. And can you really stop all the flow? I mean, it's kind of hard to push on the flow in every direction and stop it from coming in, but maybe you can. Maybe, is there some way of either theoretically or observationally determining that? The second kind, which is sort of the popular kind now, probably because it's been observed, I suppose, is winds. Right? Winds, if you think about it, that's the gas comes in, but then it goes out again. So in some sense, you've just made your star formation less efficient, because that's not all going into stars now. A lot of your mass, a lot of your fuel is being wasted and spilled back out again. But how much mass actually gets out? We know that metals are getting out at some level. We see that in the IGM. We know, we see these high velocities near the galaxy, but I mean, how much actual mass, what fraction of the mass of the galaxy is actually getting out? Now, I'm going to have a controversial idea here. Normally, we just think about the amount of mass that's going to get out as depending on the potential well depth of our halo. But as Crystal and Tim showed us, all these galaxies have like velocities about the same, 600, 700 kilometers a second. That's bigger than the potential well depth of any of these things. I mean, the potential well is like a little blip in those kinds of velocities. Perhaps it isn't the issue of how much gets out. It has nothing to do with the energetics. Maybe it has more to do with if there's anything in the way for it to get out. For example, if you have a hot mode dominated accretion halo, which is a massive one, you have gas all around you. Maybe you can't get out, like some of these simulations that Andreas has done with Pierre and stuff. They show that it's hard to get out when you have gas around you. But the small halos, the cold mode ones, there's only gas coming in from a few preferential directions. There's no hot halo. Maybe you can get out more easily. So maybe that is the more important physical process. Romeo, what do I do? Push on one? It'll go away? Okay. Finally, preheating, which we haven't been talked about much. I mean, there's a third kind of feedback where the gas is sort of affected before it ever gets to the galaxy. Right, that can add. We talked about that a little bit when we were talking about some of the scaling relations, but it can raise the gene mass, right, through photoionization, heating effects. But it can also reduce the cold mode, because to prevent this accretion shock from forming, we find that if you preheat the gas and it's hotter before it hits the accretion shock, it's a lot easier to make an accretion shock. So maybe that's a way of making more hot mode or less cold mode, for example. And what's the source of this preheating? Is it AGN, full ionization? I mean, we even heard a suggestion that it's some weird particle decay. I mean, who knows? You can somehow preheat the gas. And now to get on a topic that we sort of discussed yesterday a bit already, the effects of feedback on the IGM or the intercluster medium or the intergroup medium. One thing that I think we didn't talk about as much as we should is this result of Chuck and Kurt Adelberger's, and that's that the hydrogen absorb, this is like the only place where we really see an exact effect of the galaxy ion, the IGM. Right? They see that there isn't any neutral hydrogen near Lyman break galaxies. I don't know if you appreciate how hard it is to actually have that effect. I mean, you really need to clear out all the neutral hydrogen within 1.5, at least 1.5 co-moving megaparsecs around every galaxy in order to get that as strong as effect as they're finding. And that's really hard to do. But anyway, so this is like the only place you really see that. Now we know, we also seen this change in scaling relations for groups like we saw. Can these be related processes? Of course, the one big effect on the IGM of feedback is reionization. And we talked a lot about, you know, what caused reionization. One thing that we didn't talk about except a little bit, and I hate to open this possibility, is that maybe the IMF is varying with time or with position in the universe, which of course makes it easier to do some of these things, but then makes our predictions a lot less certain, because then you're sort of free to do almost anything. We heard that maybe seed black holes might be a source of energy at early times. And when did reionization occur? We had a lot of talk about that. I don't think we still understand. We should discuss how we might measure it. Were there multiple reionizations? Metal enrichment, I think we sort of covered that to death yesterday, but maybe we want to talk about a little bit more. How uniform is the enrichment? When did it occur? What were the sources of enrichment? And I wanted to think of some way to include some of the stuff from the first day, which I don't know what it had to do with the topic of the conference, but this is what I could think of. Is CDM the correct model on the small scales? Now, we've heard of, if you're into galaxy formation, you hear people talk about cusps in the middle of halos and satellite problem. But right, these first star simulations, if the spectrum of CDM, you know, if you had warm dark matter or something, then, you know, Tom's things are, you're sort of pretty to look at, but you're sort of irrelevant at that point. So if we see these things, it's telling us that we have something like CDM on very much smaller scales than we've been normally testing it on. So I think that's important. And the same thing with this Avi stuff. Well, I guess not Avi stuff. It's other people working on it as well, but he was the big, you know, the big spokesman for it here on these 21 centimeter high Z thingamabobbies. So, sorry I took so long. So I want to open the discussion. The panel can go back to their panel chairs now. on this first topic, on how either observationally or what theoretical or observational work or neat ideas people go think of to try to test some of these ideas that are coming out about how galaxies are actually gaining their mass. And we'll start having, if anyone on the panel wants to make some statements, then we'll open up to the audience. Panel first. Richard can go first.
Well, in my personal opinion, directly observing something is always the best way. And if you take the Frank and White prediction from 1991, these objects have effective temperatures of mid 10 to the 6 degrees and effective velocities 10 to the 40, 10 to the 41 Earth per second in the X-ray. So just go out and observe it. Given a big enough telescope, I can do that. Turns out that these things are just at the present limit of Chandra. Technical problem of Chandra is not going to low enough energy to see the emission redshift at a faster speed, like after 3. So one needs a Chandra-like X-ray telescope that goes down to 100 degrees rest rank, and one can directly observe this and see if it's really there. And thinking big, this telescope has to reach sharply 10 to minus 17 or centimeters per second in GGS units. And we now know how to build detectors that can see velocities even in kilometers per second.
It depends what mass you're at.
That's the critical cutoff.
Yeah.
But, Abhishek, you want to say something?
Yeah, I will correct this one before this predicts not only like the simulations that you saw in the literature, there's a mass cap just below 10 to the solar masses. Below which you expect no shot, no of that. So what observation will you see this?
Measurement, whatever that means.
Right.
And what you're trying to say is that detecting a few objects is not interesting. Being sensitive enough to not detect objects at a certain mass scale is interesting. That means you need about a factor of 5 or 10 greater sensitivity than what I just gave you.
So you need like a 30 meter X-ray telescope.
No,
it's
actually,
we already coupled this cluster. Even including clusters, which should be cooling in the center and should be behaving exactly like these objects. Right, we know at some level physical experiment, at least of high mass and uranium. Right? And you can ask, I mean, about Frankie White type mechanism versus the Marbury Bullet type mechanism. I think you know, in fact, now that the Frankie White mechanism doesn't work in clusters, you don't have to.
Too bad Simon's not here.
Right, I mean, and then the issue is, can you really mock it up so that you can cool things out in a sort of supersaturated method where you just sort of drop bits out, further out, and somehow take in and you go back?
Well, this is the point of this whole idea. Another idea is that we know the transversal of masses, you don't need to cool. The gas comes in cold all the way from far away, all the way into the center of the galaxy. So the question is, how do you expect to get to the transversal of mass level? How do you expect to observe the gas there and put and really test this prediction?
Yes.
Saying, yes, indeed, in this kind of object, in which the very temperature was supposed to be 10 to 6 or can I rule out
10 to 6 Kelvin
from such a forecast? Then there are really those cold flows that are
I'm trying to ask a somewhat different question, right? Which is, I mean, you want to deal with very high mass and velocity functions on the hot end of this thing, right? Can you already go in and look at the and maybe make some inferences about the nature of hot end cooling, right? Because, I mean, it's truly much easier to solve this problem by not letting the material in than by trying to kick it out. I mean, kicking it out is excruciating, right? I mean, that is much easier you can solve it by anomalous cooling or some sort of, you know, mechanism of that sort. And then the question I was going to ask Richard, the observational question is if I think he's right, but we should be observational in the end. But, I mean, if you sort of took the Mallard Bullet out of the hypothesis, it would be striking. Translated it into the constants, could you observationally rule this out? That is to say, can you somehow thought that the cooling was more distributed between the small fragments, and that somehow created the energy release to that place? But how distributed do you have to be for the cooling actually rule out the cooling flow? In other words, if you have an inhomogeneous distributed current flow, does it work?
The observables are distribution of emission energy versus temperature exactly at the opposite of every radio. With our present generation spectrometers and actually we can actually use the composition of the gas at every temperature. So that's the observable thing. You don't have to tell me if that efficient constraint is modeled.
It's a very easy thing, right? Because I mean your volume emission is just a reflection of cooling temperature anyway, right? So that's possible. Right, so
plus you get the dynamics of the gas, so we measure the kinematics of the gas at the same time. So actually, at some level, I can literally see the gas moving and what it's flowing. You can't see the flow if it's not flow. You know, if you pump it.
I must say, I don't intuitively understand how the Mallard-Bullock thing would actually work. Right? Because, I mean, in fact, you know, cooling some bit down doesn't help other bits. Right? I mean,
well, it loses the I think part of the idea is that it lowers the overall density, and since the rest of the gas has much longer cooling time.
Yeah, but you would always self-regulate, essentially.
Well, they calculate that. I mean, they work all that out in,
the
within
way
some model.
Is mainly to look at too big this gas by put roughly half the mass in those cold clouds that now orbit for a long time and delay their arrival in the center. And the other half, the hot stuff, is now less dense, and that's why it's cooling longer, and you allow wind to delay it around. And so both
I'm not sure how long what the hell.
But again, I must go back and say, I don't think that's the main issue that was raised by Neil's question. Neil pointed out that it seems that most of the gas arrives at the middle of gas with this and makes stars by a completely different mode that never went through a very nice temperature, a cold mode, a 10-4 degree. Okay? So I think this opens up a whole ballpark of new questions, theoretical and observational. For example, is it really true that what we used to think, that most stars are formed either in mergers or in some instability in disks, should be replaced by a completely different picture?
But in your picture, is the star formation rate then related to the accretion rate?
It is in the simulations. It's very closely tied.
It's a very crude prediction that needs to be worked out.
Nobody has understood physically why it's...
Let Volker speak for a change.
Yeah, I just want to disagree with this point that this kind of emphasis on the cold versus hot vision of kind of revolutionizing the way you think about galaxies. I think actually if you go back to Frank White, the cold mode has always been in the model in some sense. Exactly because if you go back, they discuss the cooling radius. And the cooling radius outside the Burr radius, they assume that all the gas comes in on a free-fall time without shocking. And this is actually in the same mass range that showed now numerically. So I think also the simulated models have always cooled most of the gas without feeding into the room temperature. So maybe we have not been
enough.
And I think it's very interesting that you point out this issue about these different modes. But I don't think that this necessarily.
There's two issues, Booker, I'd like to say. Like, I talked to Simon at length about this, and I think I finally convinced him there is something, two things that are different. One thing that's different is the geometrical situation, right? And how that might relate to these secondary physical processes, some of these feedback processes, because, as you know, the mass scale picked out by this difference is, as Avishai pointed out with, 10 different observables in his talk, very closely matches where there's a big transition in galaxy properties. So it seems coincidental that it might be that it was in there in some sense, but it definitely wasn't realized that might have an important consequence. The other thing that's different is
that,
and at high redshift,
just object to the principle idea that we have to really graph the whole theory just because clearly see that
geometrical. No, no, no. It's a new mode of star formation that we haven't invented before. It's this issue of supersonic strings.
Well, it's not necessarily new. I mean, it depends how it comes in the galaxy. There's still the issue of how it...
That's very much.
I don't think it's more static.
Right.
I just
want to
say that.
Maybe make a second point.
Oh, hold on. Let Volker make his point, then Artie's going to say something, and then Crystal wanted to talk. Okay, so...
just basically want to make this point. I'll reference your only chance to drop emissions to this. I think we have, on the theory side, worked a lot harder to understand these results that come from different codes are all
very trustworthy, because I just want to remind you that different SPH methods, tend to give different results for the amount of cold gas
that's down.
As also do, by the way, AMR-based simulations. Mm. Mike Norman, who is not here anymore, they last year had papers on cooling in clusters, and they cooled only 8.5% or so in clusters. As a result that I can't
understand either.
So there's more work for us to do here. And I think this is really not so much an observational problem then, but first of all, a purely computational problem to understand what is the right answer.
But Volker, it's not purely computational. If we can't agree between our simulations for a long time, the one way to solve it is to actually look in the universe and see what's happening. I mean,
frankly, I think you haven't quite hard enough, right?
But before I move on to Dart, I just want to say that the other difference between within the semi-analytic is that, especially at high redshift, it's in the semi-analytic, it's like all one or all the other. There's never a mixed mode. And we find that there is a long period of mixed mode at high redshift, which since the one mode is 2.5 to 5 times more efficient, that means that at high redshift, you can get larger star formation rates by having larger accretion flows onto the galaxy. All right, so now Artie's next, and then...
We go back to the first slide. Please.
That is the first slide.
No, there was one before.
No, that was the first slide.
Yeah, maybe it's the second one.
Well, we're on this slide. Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, back.
I mean,
that first one.
This?
Okay.
Here, you want
I just want to point out there's observational evidence for that.
Good. Well, I know that's a data point.
I mean,
there's a merger data point, actually, which I could put on here.
Right, let me just, may I finish what I'm saying?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. One of the things that's amazed me for the last few years in these Van-Lyman Alpha systems is that omega gas, neutral gas, is constant almost over that entire range. And I've never understood that before, because as I said during my talk, we are seeing star formation in the Van-Lyman Alpha systems. And the only way I can understand that is if the global accretion rate is comparable to the global star formation rate. That's the only way it makes sense. So is this a generic prediction of all these models? I mean, why, first of all, what does this mean physically? Why does the global star formation rate know about
that? Okay, so in our simulations, once a parcel of gas enters the galaxy, it works out on average that it's around for a few hundred million years or half a billion years, and then it turns into stars. And the reason for that is just because we have a rough Schmidt law for, not that we're using a Schmidt law, but it works out to being like it reproduces the Schmidt law for the star formation rate. So if you dump more gas in, the surface density goes up and you get more star formation, so it sort
so
of
the
stays.
The time scales are right that you can get rid of that gas faster.
But you put in an ad hoc algorithm for star formation.
Yeah, I guess it must be.
Well, of course it's ad hoc, but it's less ad hoc than, for example, a semi-analytic calculation in the following sense, that in semi-analytic calculations, the star formation rates are always based on the global properties of the galaxy. Whereas here, our star formation rates are based on the local physics of the gas. So, I mean, it is sort of parcel by parcel in the galaxy. Turning
whatever the explanation is, I mean, there's empirical evidence for this.
Well, that's good to know.
What I'm saying.
But actually, you do better, I think, to think about our own Milky Way, wouldn't you? Right? I mean, how long does a parcel of gas sit around before it ends up, you know, getting eaten into stars, right?
Yeah, it's short compared to the age of the Milky Way. Yeah.
Well, on average, it must be, we have a solar mass a year of accretion, roughly, and we have a solar mass a year of star formation,
right.
So it's roughly about.
Yeah, right. But I think the actual answer is it's probably a billion years or so, isn't it? Right? I mean, off order.
Crystal.
Yeah. I mean, a few orders.
Oh, you have.
I mean, and that instantly says it's instantaneous in some sense, right?
But it's some type of global reflux.
Yeah.
Let's hear it from our wind expert.
So on the issue of these hot halos around galaxies, I think there's one observation we're forgetting about, which was, I believe it was Andrew Benson that took for L-starish galaxies and added many nearby galaxies together, and I thought he had significant limits.
Upper limit.
The X-ray surface, but I thought they were significant upper limits,
yeah.
And that there's not as much cooling gas there as
well, but then that was
predicted.
Then the theory, the following year, Jasper Sorensen redid the
Sommer-Larsen.
Yeah, Sommer-Larsen redid the calculation and claimed that the upper limits were no longer a significant constraint on the theory.
It depends critically on how you distribute the gas right near the galaxy. But if you assume that it's R to the minus 2 profile, which is what Benson did, and of course, you know, the emission is going up as density squared, you get a lot of emission right in the center, and that was what they weren't detecting. But if you make just a little bit of core, which seems to be what you find in the simulations, then you can lower those limits quite a bit, and that's what happened there.
I mean, one other way to perhaps look at how much gas is around these galaxies is through the dynamics of the winds that you see going out. I mean, there's some constraints based on how fast they do or don't slow down that tells you if there's stuff there that you're not seeing through its ionization streams or whatever. I mean, in fact, I think that's how the hot halo of the Milky Way was actually discovered. I mean, through the dynamics of sodium clouds, trying to understand how they can move around. So maybe another approach to take to try to understand how much accreting gas there could be in the halo.
Let me ask Crystal a question. Since you've shown beautifully how a galaxy can self-illuminate its gas, is there a potential to actually look at the cold mode accretion at high redshift by using the galaxy stars themselves as a backlight?
Sure, I think that's what already tells us that the accretion, I mean, at least in the cold phase, cannot cover a large solid angle. I mean, both in the Lyman-Bright galaxies and nearby in the sodium D observations, I mean, we both looked at hundreds of systems, and we see inflows, I mean, Chuck said not at all at high redshift. Something like 1 out of 40 cases at low redshift, do you see any inflow?
I know Andres went.
Point is pretty close to what I was trying to say. I think that it's almost unavoidable that you have at the same time winds flowing out of the galaxy and cold material coming in, as in this situation. We see it all the time in simulations, I think. And we know also that it happens in any scale of cosmological objects, starting from stars. So you accretion disk that outflows at the same time. So I think it's pretty normal that we see such type of situation. The problem that I have with that, with the cold mode is there. The question is how to observe it, because apparently we can never see it, as Crystal was saying. So that is the problem that we have to face now.
Right, you can see it in, you know, that stuff is cooling in Lyman Alpha and Helium 2 emission lines. I mean, you can see that. It's hard to see, but people are starting to see these Lyman Alpha blobs, and I think that's probably the single most direct way I know of to actually observe.
Remember, in the standard picture, most of the energy is coming out in X-rays, which is what started Richard off at the beginning of how you're going to see this stuff. But in the cold mode, of course, it's all coming out in Lyman Alpha. I mean, and helium cooling lines, and that's where all the energy of galaxy formation itself is coming out. So
another observational approach is, can you calculate the predicted Lyman alpha surface brightness
and how patchy it is, and is there a possible experiment to observe that? Funny you should
yes,
ask.
Yes. Yes. So, it's coming soon.
Yep.
Steve Ferronetto and I, with Volker Spring and Lars Hornquist, just wrote a paper, another paper on that, which is announced in September. And we find it's actually very difficult, of course, to predict the Lyman alpha emission, because most of it comes out when, in a regime where rate of transfer is important. However, on larger scales, the Lyman alpha blobs that you're discussing, we should be able to predict it reasonably well. And the simulations, although they do predict that most of the Lyman alpha emission comes from this cold mode accretion, it doesn't explain these Lyman alpha blobs. Because those are so extreme in terms of size, they probably have more to do with winds.
Well, like, not necessarily. It depends on the detailed radiative transfer. Of course, you can get scattering and make these things be larger.
It's difficult to get. Yeah, and it's difficult to get. You know, scattering is mostly in frequency space, not in real space.
Hidden AGM. There's no AG. Chandra observations of roughly 30 Lyman alpha blobs on only one AGN. So.
And another one is
So that means only a small fraction of today of these objects. And at the instant you observe them, only a small fraction of them have AGN in them. That's the advantage of the helium emission, is it's not as optically thin, so you don't have to.
Well, the Lyman alpha emission, optically thin Lyman alpha emission, is not that far below the detection thresholds of current instrumentation. I mean, we've been arguing that people should go after, make Lyman alpha cosmic web satellites or whatever, image it directly.
Giant fabric grow. Anyone else have anything to say on this? How do galaxies grow?
People are trying.
Oh, Tom does.
Just one point, you know, as we're talking about this hot mode and having gas be sort of outside, right? That this has a direct influence also in our picture of understanding of all the how the angular momentum got into all the gas. If we're, you know, and we heard this earlier, that, and we know about the Milky Way, that only a small fraction of the whole cosmic baryons made it into the dark matter potential well. So what that means is you had a force that was as strong as the force that brings in the material, sort of the gravitational infold force, that acted on the gas. That force is then 20 times larger, more or less, than the torquing force. But nevertheless, we still keep talking about that all the angular momentum of galaxies is built up by the tidal torques of large-scale dark matter. Whereas all the other arguments we make is that we claim is that there's 10 times larger forces that act on the gas. And of course, I'm not naive in thinking that, you know, if you perfectly do it spherical, then of course you can't exert torques on it, but none of us is talking about spherical galaxies anymore. So I think one very clear thing is what we keep forgetting sometimes is that perhaps the angular momentum of the gas has nothing to do with the angular momentum of the dark matter, and that it actually is not affected by the tidal forces. And I think sort of this whole picture then, if you sort of like to distinguish between this hot and cold mode, is that in the cold mode you could still preserve something of the large-scale tidal field for the angular momentum, because you make it so small and no pressure forces act on these pockets they come in. And whereas the hot mode, you know for a fact that the angular momentum has nothing to do with the tidal forces anymore. And so I think, you know, that's a whole area that opens up, that you can connect these different types of observations to it. Now, the only other thing I would have iterated as well is that with these stacking analysis that you can do with current X-ray telescopes, I mean, you have huge samples of galaxies now.
Yeah, it's just a technical problem. Just a reminder, Tom's absolutely right. You can achieve effective flux thresholds of the ones I talked about today with Chandra by stacking. It's just a technical issue that, unfortunately, the detector on Chandra that does this has a contamination problem that prevents low-energy photons from entering the detector. And so if that had not happened, we would already have this answer. But unfortunately, those photons can't make it into the Chandra detector because of this bad outgassing from that was unlucky. I'd like to ask a theoretical question. I was under the impression that the angular momentum problem in galaxies was still important, that one could not properly reproduce from the numerical simulations the angular momentum distributions. And following up what Tom just said, in the cold mode, that must still be a problem. Or am I just not up to date? I'll answer that first, obviously, being taking prerogative as chair. I think there's two issues with that. I mean, one is, from the simulation side, things that Matthias and Julio have done show that when they actually do a simulation of a galaxy, the disks are too small. To be somewhat controversial, my take on that isn't really a disk size problem, but a morphological type problem. I think their problem more is, every one of those calculations, there was a major merger after redshift 1, and before the merger, they had perfectly large disks. So it wasn't really a lack of angular momentum originally, as opposed to, you know, you merge two disk galaxies together, and you make yourself an elliptical galaxy. So that begs then the question, well, why do all of their galaxies have major mergers? And that's something we have to look at. In our simulations, we have lots of galaxies that don't have major mergers, and hence we would have a lot of disks if we could resolve it, I think. Then there's this other issue, more on analytic type things, where you look at the angular momentum distribution of the dark halo. If you assume the gas has the same, this is stuff that Frank Vandenbosch and others have worked on, shows that you have to really selectively, you know, bring in the higher angular momentum material. But you would expect that to be in the outer part of the halo, not the middle of the halo, and you think the stuff that would cool would be in the middle part of the halo. So that's how the cold mode might help, because no longer are you forced to just bring material in from the part of the halo that you would think would have the lowest angular momentum, because it's sort of coming along these long streams. I don't know if Avishai had more to say.
Yeah, let me give you my take on this, which is by no means the only possibility. The problem, as I read, especially from talking to Matthias and Julio Navarro and so on, is that the main problem is that you produce too many bulges, and you usually don't produce enough disks with no bulges. This means that you accumulate too much low angular momentum stuff in your galaxy. Okay? In other words, what you want to do in your modeling is to get rid of the low angular momentum tail of the distribution that you initially have in your halo. Now, here's my take on how this can happen. Okay? You have the cold mode and the hot mode. The cold mode typically come along filaments from far away. It's those filaments that build those halos from very far away. But if you come from very far away, you can imagine you need a very little impact parameter from being radiant, and you gain a lot of orbital angular momentum. So it's very natural, yet to be tested properly, that the cold mode brings in a lot of angular momentum. And this is what getting you the disk. The hot mode, on the other hand, is the stuff that's easy to get rid of, because it's dilute, and any kind of waves or feedback will easily find its way among those dense filaments, cold filaments, and get rid of the hot mode. So this gives you a natural segregation where you can lose the low angular momentum stuff and build your disk from the high angular stuff. But it's by no means a finished, you know, scenario.
Matthias, has something to say on these?
Yeah. First of all, that scenario is exactly what you simulated. You have to go get out.
No. Feedback. This is feedback. You don't get rid of the whole stuff enough. You know, that's the problem.
But, that's the point. The cold mode stuff, that's the stuff that is collapsed, that's the stuff that first time recording, that's the stuff that loses angular momentum due to the angular distribution. Your hot mode essentially has the same angular momentum distribution as you would expect from the dark matter halo. So the problem actually is in the cold mode, it's not in the hot mode.
And the merging too, you miss the merging is a problem.
That's also. But maybe also on the disk size issue, I think it's important to know that if we, in those model galaxies where we see this, the disks have a proper size. They're actually pretty good disks, but we never get something which is an SC galaxy or even a C galaxy. You always get huge bulges, and you get them due to the cold mode.
And due to the merging, I mean.
So I think it's my job here to speak up for wind. So if the material
that is your job.
In the bulge region, if half of it goes into stars and half of it goes out in wind, which is what you would naively get from the empirical calibration, is that enough to make a difference or not?
Yeah. What you have to do is, I think,
let me come back to this problem of disk formation. There is, I think one should not forget the influence of the detailed structure of the interstellar medium, how the cloud is formed. So far, only one published example, I think, of a nice disk-only system, a large disk, and that's a paper by Frank Robertson, Lars, myself, and Naoki Yoshida. And there, we emphasize that we think the success that we have, which we achieved by looking at several high-resolution halos, and this is the only system
it was successful among, you know, 10 or so we looked at. And it is a very nice disk with an exponential scalar profile, etc. And it doesn't have this problem of being dominated by a huge bulge. It has a reasonable rotation curve, etc., etc. By all standards, a reasonable fit. When we think this is only due to our sub-resolution model for the multiphase ISM, which basically prevents this cold gas to become extremely dense and become, you know, lose its momentum very efficiently to the rest of the gas. So I think this is all intertwined. It's not just generation of angular momentum on large scales or by the mode of the infall. It is also very important how you model this, the regular, you know, how the star formation is regulated inside the ISM itself. That is, plays an absolutely crucial role as well. If you have a massive gas disk at 10 to the 4K, this is impossible to keep this dynamically stable for a long time. So it really depends on how you treat star formation.
Yeah. And feedback. I think the key point that you should suspect in the simulation is whether the feedback is done in the way that we move the right part. That's probably an unknown.
But right, it is the case in Matthias's simulations, they have, you know, mergers of like 1 to 3 at redshift 0.7. I mean, I don't think any of us would expect such a system to end up as a disk galaxy, or at least not a disk, at least a disk galaxy with a huge bulge. I mean, I don't think any of us would expect that.
We better move on.
All right. What have we been all right. Let's talk about the effects of feedback on galaxies we've been sort of talking about already.
One of the ones we discussed yesterday, so you can go to the margarita.
there's not that much time left. They have margarita mix out in the hallway somewhere. Someone wants to bring it in. So does anyone on the panel have anything to say about either observationally or theoretically how we might address these different kinds of...
We'll start with the observation perspective. And
all right, go ahead, Richard.
AGN, I think we've, in the X-ray community, have just started to observe winds. PowerPoint, but you don't need, I can just describe it with my hands. There are now a few AGN winds that have been observed in the X-ray. Direct observations, images, and spectra. And really there are maybe 1.5 handfuls. So I think we're just starting to constrain the amount of energy that AGN can put mechanically into either the ISM or the local IGM. I think in the next few years, 2 or 3 years, there'll be a fair amount of progress in this field, and we'll actually know the numbers for low redshift, low luminosity sources.
So how much can you actually constrain the mass?
Yes, okay. So this two ways. One, in C42 galaxies, where the nucleus is blocked, you can now see low surface brightness stuff. In a few objects, you see these cones of emission, hot ionized gas flowing out, presumably along the cone. And it's just like with Dave Strickland seeing, and you're seeing, and the super winds, except here it's clearly an AGN. You see these sort of hollow cones. This is seen in NGC 4945 as the best case. It's the closest C42. So here you have, as just you see directly in the same super winds, you get the same type of information. So you know how to proceed from there. The other way one can proceed is that in a small number of cases, you have time variability of a central object. This is a C41 now, where you're seeing absorption along the line of sight. You can get the column densities and the ions and their velocity structure. And of course, the magic number you need is the density. And therefore, you can get upper limits on the density by or determine limits by watching the gas respond to the continuum. So you need multiple observations with the gratings of Chandra to get that type of data. Right now, only two such data sets exist. Those data sets put upper bounds on the density, roughly 10 to the 7th, which implies that the winds are carrying a very large amount of energy and originate from fairly large scales. So if those two objects are representative, we've already made progress in understanding this process.
But you say that, but that's the energy. I mean, it's still, to me, an issue. Even if you have the energy available, I mean, I don't think the energetics of stopping the stuff from coming in is so much the issue as to how in the world does you push in every direction equally so that, you know...
Well, I mean, no, we've made one step forward. I mean, before, you know, the AGN was a battery that potentially held all this energy. Now you've detected the wires.
Yeah.
How that energy is
flowing. But actually, I mean, invoking AGN as a way of avoiding ejecting material with stars. Right, but I don't know of any AGN that don't have stars associated with them, so I don't quite actually see what this buys you.
Oh,
I mean, AGN activity tracks star formation activity, right? I mean, and therefore trying to solve your problems by putting in artificial AGN in objects which don't actually have star formation, which I think is what was being done, actually.
I was talking about that.
I mean, no, let me just be abusive in a theoretical sense, right?
Since Simon isn't here either, you might as well go
exactly,
ahead.
I can be as rude as I like. Right? Doesn't get a chance to respond. I mean, it doesn't seem to me to actually buy you very much. I mean, what you want is a neutron bomb, essentially, right, that can somehow get things not coming in, right, without doing any damage to what you want, right? I mean, and I don't think AGN are that, right? That's just not a solution, right? So I think I would like to say, I mean, why bother, right? I mean, it's always easier to get stuff out of the supernova than it is to get things out with AGN, right? I mean, they're more distributed into the gas, they're more percolated through the galaxy, all the rest of these things. If you're going to get things out, you're going to get them out of the supernova. You're probably not going to get them out with the AGN.
Did you measure enough stuff coming out?
Enough stuff to do what exactly?
Well, we've heard that you have to get rid of what fraction of the mass of systems to...
Basically, you have to reduce the mass. I mean, basically, the problem is, again, if either the semi-analytic calculations or the simulations are all correct, is that these high-mass galaxies, meaning things not that much above L star, basically any galaxy you see in the universe that's an old elliptical galaxy on the red sequence, you have to... You would predict, you know, many times, at least a few to many times more gas in that system. So they'd be both too massive, and hence, plus that gas is coming in even now. So they'd be continually making stars, and they'd be blue. The problem with your idea, Len, is what Simon pointed out. Not that I like Simon's solution, but I mean, the way the solution must work, though, it can't be supernova, because right, the supernova goes off, and then you get rid of the gas. But then more gas still wants to come in. You can't have any more stars form because you want your thing to be red. So you're sort of in.
No, forgive me. I wasn't actually trying to argue that was the solution. I was just saying that, you know, if you were ejecting material, it's always much easier to do it with supernova, I think, than it is with AGN.
I think that doesn't mean at this point. I don't know where it's coming from, this notion. It's actually the opposite, right? Especially with big systems, you eject. There, the black holes grow
panel
there,
first
to the stellar mass, and they look together. They grow to larger sizes proportionally, right? So there is more energy available per unit barium of mass in the big galaxies for AGN. And this energy is very concentrated. And we see the effects of this feedback. And the simulations that we recently carried out also show it's very easy to do this with
panel first.
It's clear there's a lot of energy available in the AGN.
Well, these political talk shows, and they're all yelling at each other.
Distribute that energy in the interstellar medium of the galaxy. I don't think anyone would object to the idea that the AGN is very effective, perhaps, at heating the IGN. I mean, if I picture winds, I see this energy from the starburst, right, being thermalized on scales of kiloparsecs, and this clearly affects the ISM, whereas when I picture an AGN, I picture a jet and these radio modes and things, and I mean, could most of the energy actually be dumped on scales of kiloparsecs?
Yeah, but there are simulations that have shown that from AGN, you know, these bubbles that uplift, just by buoyancy effects in radio modes, uplift a lot of cold gas across the horizon.
I think Len's point is a good. To me, the biggest problem is Simon said he didn't know what the process was. It could be AGN, but it had to have the following characteristic, which is it had to operate without star formation over long periods of time.
No.
Boker, the problem is that observationally, AGN, as Len said, are tied. You don't see usually lots of star formation, lots of AGN activity, and here you need to have AGN operating over a long time, you know, like 5 billion years, without any star formation occurring, and that's.
Yeah.
That's harder to...
It's not what you see. But just to comment also on your theoretical point, I mean, I think entrainment is much easier, and I think that's what Crystal's trying to say. Loading is easier for supernova than it is for AGN. I mean, and then you're much more likely to put things out in an unloaded fashion with AGN, and much more likely to put them out in a loaded fashion with supernova. And what you want is a loaded thing. Now, just to go back to your point, I wasn't trying to argue that supernova worked. I mean, I can't understand how any of these mechanisms can hope to work, right? I mean, because in fact, you're never going to eject more material than is coming in, right? I mean, it's not mechanisms that are going to stop inflows. I mean, the mechanisms that may slightly reduce the amount of material that comes in.
You just go back in time to the bottom-heavy IMF and cooling flow.
Yeah, I mean, you want to do something else, and I think your other solutions surely have to be the right way to go on this.
Is the panel, can we open it up to the floor? So I know Nick was waiting.
Well, I think the difference between IGN and supernova is the energy and the temperature of the gas is throwing out.
is much, much higher. Those jets are going at a good fraction of the speed of light. And to deposit those electrons with temperatures 10 to the 8, and you create bubbles. You see those bubbles around your galaxy. They're megaparsec in size. So you take your galaxy, surround it by a bubble of megaparsec in size of 10 to the 8 gas. It will never cool. So it will stop all accretion forever. Right? So it will work for those billions of years, as you said.
I don't quite see what having bubbles or relatively plasma bubble does for you, right? Material doesn't care about that. It just...
It has pressure, right? You create a hot bubble. It will have pressure. Why would it fall in?
Yeah, but it's a nice, it's a hydrodynamically unstable situation, isn't it?
Why is it hydrodynamically unstable?
Hold on, let me give you a microphone.
No, it's okay.
Well, I think that this could be better to be studied. To a first glance, I think that if you have a, sure.
See, it's like one of these political talk shows.
If you can make it spherical completely, I agree. But the jets, the energy is also always bipolar in jets, right? Yeah. Then in
sure.
Yes. Yes. Right, but the gas is coming from outside, is going around the plume, and
then... No, those plumes, let us just say a little bit, and those plumes are already covered up in the form of the profile. The next thing that will happen, if you don't really kill the stabilities and stuff, just pull through them, right? I mean, it's not... No, it's probably a big part of the gas. The real point is, I mean, low density material is not very effective at stopping higher density material.
What some simulators have tried to demonstrate...
Yeah, let's hear from another point of view for a second.
Something that has been explored in simulations is that when you create the bubble, you also create turbulence. And if you entrain low entropy material and then mix it with the higher entropy material that's above it, then you can actually reduce the cooling rate. Okay, so it's not always a matter of shocking. What might be a solution, which has been explored to some extent in simulations, is you first entrain the low entropy material and then mix it with higher entropy stuff. And that can actually suppress some of the cooling. So yeah, stuff could slide around, but if you generate enough turbulence, mixing can help you out.
Well, these are high demand mechanics. Well, it's being stored.
Ken wanted to say something.
I guess I'm a little bit confused. In large galaxies, it's very hard to blow. In large galaxies, it's very hard to get stuff out. And I keep in my mind models that were done a few years ago for the Milky Way, where you have supernovae go off, even tens of supernovae go off, and you basically can get the gas up only so high before you basically form a shell. And then you can just keep exploding supernovae in there for as long as you want, and you're never going to break it out. So part of the problem with, I mean, you need to have multiple mechanisms, I think, to get the gas out, which is, I think, what Len was getting at earlier. And who cares if it's just supernovae or just AGN? It's got to be some combination. We're having trouble just getting gas out of galaxies.
But AGN has more energy, so it may have hope.
Well, maybe, but I mean, maybe one possibility is that you actually evacuate some of the region, and other mechanisms then help push you over the edge to get the gas out. I guess I'm worried that if you entrain too much material, that you actually do form basically a cap, and those caps are actually fairly stable, modulo these Rayleigh-Taylor instabilities, and you spend a lot of, even with a lot of photons, you spend a lot of energy just ionizing the gas inside the bubbles, and you don't actually break out.
Remember, for ellipticals, and even in clusters, very stringent limits. You can't have very much of this gas leak in at all, or you're going to end up being too blue. So, I mean, it really has to be a highly efficient process. You want to say something? Anyone?
I mean, I think one thing we've learned from the observations is that the energy is a necessary condition for getting this gas out, but it's not sufficient, and the reason is the geometry of these systems, right? I mean, in these small dwarf galaxies, there's more than enough supernova energy to expel the entire interstellar medium, because the flows break out in these bipolar flows, you vent a lot of the energy out of the galaxy without the slipping of this. I mean, I think that's the general objection to the AGN. It needs to be demonstrated that the jet doesn't just bore a hole in the galaxy and dump the energy somewhere else.
I object to the use of the word jet in most of this process. In radio loud objects, yes, you see direct jets. But what we're seeing in radio quiet objects now, in fact, one could have argued from the unified model, we should have known this a long time ago, these are wide-angle cones with 30 or 40 degree open angles in radio quiet optics. So okay. It's not a pencil beam shooting, you know, death rays along the line of sight.
Sure,
it's but it's also
exactly. No, so can you show a picture of 4395?
Yes.
Good. You mean just the restaurant over here? Is it open now? We would be towed away.
Yeah,
we
start from
oh well, it's a lock of 4945. And but it's not a nuclear, clearly a nuclear starburst, and this feature is right on the nucleus. And then another, and we actually see velocities in the X-ray gas. So we can associate those velocities to the image. So I just want to remind us that at least if you use type 2 Seyfert as your model of where what the winds are likely to be like, and Andrew Wilson pointed this out many years ago, they're big cones with 30 or 40 degree opening angles, which may make it a lot easier. Put the energy in the right place.
But can you if you push it that way, would it have stops the stuff from coming in?
Well, that's the answer
we have. You know, the canonical time is very long. Then you can get from falling for a long time.
Ramil wanted to say something.
Here's my main point that I think of when I sort of end up down the AGN road against all my better judgment. So the main point is that, you know, in order to get this galaxy, you it's not a question of blowing the galaxy out. If you want to solve the massive galaxy problem, which means, you know, truncate star formation at early times in these massive systems, you cannot afford to have very much accretion. You have to stop the gas from flowing in. So that means you have to take a very, now AGN or starburst or supernova, any of these things are basically an accretion driven process. I mean, you have to get the fuel down there either on the black hole or however. But the thing about AGN is that you can turn a very small amount of accretion into quite a bit of energy. And that's the main difference, right? And in starburst, you can't do that. You need to have a lot of material in there to get the amount of energy you need to do that. And because we don't see the star formation, that sort of drives you to AGN as the necessary ingredient to solve this problem.
Unless some Mahler bullock or some other thing prevents the gas from
unless
cooling.
Something like that is going. Right.
In this observational side, I think one of the, whatever the precise processes may be here, one of the fundamental unknowns is the AGN duty cycle. And the AGN duty cycle really determines what fraction of the time these processes may act. And that could actually, at least in some sorts of environments, very dense, highly massive environments, could speak in favor of the radio mode. Because there are indications of radio jets, the whole radio power being switched on for a much longer time than, say, a normal quasar. So there we may be speaking about 10 to the 8 years compared to 10 to the 7 or maybe even shorter periods for a normal AGN quasar, radio quiet quasar type object. But we really are very uncertain to orders of magnitude about the time scales here.
So what I'm hearing is that we want AGN feedback because you don't want to form stars at the same time. At the same time, I hear discussion, how can you show that this energy is not coming from stars rather than from AGN? So if AGN are going to be solving this problem, then we need to see lots of AGN active without any star formation that coincides with them. Yet it usually goes hand in hand.
Well, I think specifically, referring to central galaxies.
No, it's not just. It has to be basically almost every galaxy in the red sequence, at least for some length of time, had to have this accretion shut down.
All the massive galaxies need to be killed, right? Essentially.
Right.
So, I mean, and that's actually, I think, not too. I think all the evidence is that there's a correlation between the stuff. Right. So I don't think you can separate them out.
I think separation is unlikely, but. Because, as Crystal was showing, we already have some observations of low redshifts, that AGN can give this gas more velocity than the stars alone. So I think we may think of it as a booster phenomenon. It's not an if and or, it's an and.
But unfortunately.
But then it doesn't. Then neither one. It just, if it, they're both. It doesn't help. You need something else still to solve this other problem.
You're forgetting that he can't afford star formation because the
exactly.
Colors are wrong.
Exactly, it's the colors.
So I was amazed to find that Galax is now detecting star formation in massive galaxies at redshift zero. It's about two or three orders of magnitude down from where we would expect it, but it's still there. So it's not that we need to absolutely truncate it. What we need to do is figure out a way to turn that little bit of star formation into something that then, you know, blows away the rest of, or prevents the rest of the stuff from cooling.
I don't think it's true that AGN is always correlated with star formation.
I mean, it's related. It's the statistical probability. Yeah. The probability of a high star formation, high star formation rate galaxy being an AGN is higher.
No, but this, but
how about the other way around? Can you have a big population?
This does not help you, right? Because in fact, you have to separate them in time sequences, actually.
But how do you explain BLRK?
Oh, that's a counterexample to that.
Oh, no, right. There's no star formation whatsoever.
Sure. A radio?
Reactive, very active. They're the most active objects in the universe.
Well,
yes.
The radio galaxies are some of the more luminous. They're the more luminous objects, right?
Yeah. The model for BLX is that far.
There's not much energy in a BLX. Not gonna stop a cluster flow. Yeah.
Or not.
Right, one person at a time here.
Gas flows back. And so supernova feedback doesn't prevent gas from falling from the galaxy for a long time. It flows back. Enough time so you don't see that galaxy. And so it may not be an AGN. But AGN potentially can prevent this gas from falling in the subject of those relative instabilities. And what happens to those jets? And where there's a lot of bubbles of relativistic plasma around the galaxy. But potentially it can prevent, at least in principle, this gas from falling back into the galaxy for billions of years. So AGN can kill this galaxy forever. As supernova, we know from everyone who attempted to kill a galaxy with supernova program that it cannot do that. It can wound this galaxy, but it can never kill.
Let's hear from David for a second.
It doesn't matter. No, because it all happens so fast compared to this 5 billion years.
Let's hear another viewpoint. Nick!
I want to remind you about this again. Right? Simon White has shown a very detailed simulated model that star formation AGN activity was treated concurrently in a self-consistent fashion, and at least in a more self-consistent fashion than our discussion we're having, back of the envelope of that. So that shows that you can reproduce the correct, bad elliptical, massive ellipticals. Right?
No, that's definitely true, Bauer. The question is, does it match other observations, which is what Len was bringing up?
Well, there's a whole slew of observations, as you've seen. And I mean, it's not, I'm not saying
that. BLX, I don't think we have enough energy already to do what's needed. Okay, let David say something for a change.
I wanted to change. I'm getting lost in all of this. My understanding is that the ellipticals have gas in them. They got plenty of gas in them, right? It's hot. There are cool little clumps that you can see in. And if you look in the infrared, they emit infrared, little clumps of cooler stuff in them. And it wouldn't surprise that some of that would make a few stars. So I guess the question is, how do you explain the temperature of the gases in the... I don't think you want to stop the gas coming in. I mean, they've got gas, don't they?
No, the elliptical...
Why is that the issue?
The ellipticals today represents a few years of stellar mass loss. It's not primordial. It hasn't been around, and it's left over from the initial collapse. So it's whatever, three...
Including the halo? I mean...
It's planetary nebula and red giant winds being thermalized and shocked in the potential well of the galaxy. So that can easily account for the gas we see today.
Okay, so...
Well, okay, now you're raising a separate issue. Okay, that's the amount of gas inside the optical, whatever, envelope of the galaxy. But a fair fraction of ellipticals... the gas profiles just keep on going out. You see no stars, and an optical observer would not call them a group because there's no other stars. And these have been given
fossil groups.
Right? And so this, so an optical observer, it's a giant elliptical galaxy, but the gas just goes forever. And so you ask where that gas came from, and that can't come from stars. It has to be quasi-primordial.
Let's hear from Ken for a second.
Well, I have a question for the modelers. In the models, how effective
I think David asked this the other day, how effective is tidal disruption at getting gas out of galaxies as a function of galaxy mass? Not effective at any scale?
Well, how does this relate to our...
Well, I'm just saying, in terms of actually getting gas in and out of galaxies,
first of all,
is it...
we want to get gas out of the center of galaxies.
Right.
So that certainly doesn't help.
Well, in a merger, you lose some gas.
Yeah.
But a lot of these galaxies are sitting in the middle of potential wells. I mean, they're basically the garbage can where it's all adding up. It's not...
I see this happening in COVID, I don't see this happening, so
okay.
I don't know if we're ready.
Okay. Do you want to say something? The last comment on this topic, and we'll move on to the next topic.
I think the primary problem is it's stopping the L-star galaxy from turning into a 10 L-star galaxy from all this infalling gas that's coming later. So if you're putting all your heating well far out, that's probably a good idea, I would say, with the AGN. And then the issue of, is this other coal gas going to get in anyway, even if you, you kind of imagine this hot shock shell that's kind of far away from the galaxy is probably the best thing you could do. And now, is it good enough? I don't think we know. I mean, we can't just really dismiss that yet. We need to explore that in detail.
All right. Well, we still have some time. Let's move on to the next topic, which was talked a bit yesterday. But particularly the first part of this, I think this observation of Chuck's, I think it's still difficult to explain if it really holds up. I don't know if anyone on the panel has anything to say about any of...
Changes, kinetic relations?
Yeah, that's the whole stuff, that, well, Richard could expound on, or Mark, or Gus, if you were here. The fact that the standard Kaiser scaling relationships that you expect break down for groups. Basically, groups are underluminous in X-rays, is the simple way of putting it.
The gas is puffed up.
Right, or something. I mean, there's different ways to explain it, but I mean...
Well, it's not a floor.
Well, let's see if the panel has anything to say in any of these topics.
Okay.
I just like to say that, if you want to study where many people believe that the entropy, I'll call it problem in groups, is related to the previous view graph, which is the generation of heat in the universe. It's the same problem, and that groups are a relic or fossil of that process. If one can actually observe the entropy in groups as a function of redshift, out to interesting redshift, one might be actually able to measure this process. And I think that's technically not impossible. So that would be another nice data point to think about. Chandra has already detected groups at redshifts near 1. So
you want to say anything?
Yes, actually emission from groups at redshift about 0.8. A little bit less, 5%. Well, we don't know the temperatures very well.
I have a question to Richard and Mark. I remember John Mokey, I think, at some point claimed that this luminosity temperature break is actually an isothermal effect because groups are dimmer and they don't integrate all the way to video radius. So what is the current status of this?
So the original observations of a sharp break in the luminosity temperature relation on group scales were by Trevor Ponman, and that turns out to be a sample that has a real selection bias. Osman and Ponman have recently published a broader sample where they show there's a very large dispersion of groups where some are consistent with an extrapolation of the cluster luminosity temperature relation, and some also show a sharp break. So the claim of Ponman of several years ago that there was a sharp break is now more ambiguous, but clearly the dispersion in the luminosity temperature relation gets much wider when you go down onto group scales. However, the overall scaling relation from clusters to groups does indicate some sort of extra heating process. So the question was about the iron temperature relation groups, and maybe Richard is a better person to discuss that.
The bottom line is that at the mass scale of groups, there's a lot more dispersion in every property. The abundances are scattered much more widely.
Because half of them are really groups, they're just the projections.
Scatter much more widely. The surface brightness distribution scatter much more widely. The ratio of stars to gas scatters much more widely. So, the post-explainable observational uncertainty. Okay, well, I'm going to answer the question. Yes, the surface brightness profile of groups is very shallow. So, our present imaging observations go out at best to a third of the virial radius, or in clusters they go out to 0.7 of the virial radius. So, there is this extrapolation problem. And you can handle it two separate ways. You can truncate the objects with the last data point you observe, or you can extrapolate the models. You don't get much luminosity out there because the surface, you know, it's just not much density, but you get a lot of mass. So the luminosity temperature correlation will not be fixed by going out to larger radii, but now you have a lot more gas mass than you thought you had. So if you project this in maybe a more interesting domain, what fraction of the gas is in, what fraction of the mass is in hot gas, you will get much more than you would have thought. So it's a different statement. We have to be, just think back 20 years when people were still trying to measure the halos of elliptical galaxies. It's exactly that problem. And it's actually technically a very difficult one to solve.
Does anyone have any idea, so that's, we've been spending a lot of time on number two, does anyone have any idea of observational ways of testing whether or not the galaxies are actually affecting the IGM in a direct kind of damaging way besides just dumping metals into them? Does anyone have any? New voice.
So I was actually just going to ask Crystal what she thought the prospects were for this tomography that Chuck mentioned. I think it also addresses this cold and hot mode issue and a lot of the issues we've talked about in terms of the multi-phase medium. What are the prospects observationally? You know, not give me a new telescope that'll be done and when we're all dead. What are the prospects for doing tomography, multi-phase, kind of getting all the ionization, or getting as many ionization states as you can, sight lines, you know, everywhere you can, you know, and a bunch of systems to get good statistics? What are the prospects?
Well, it's very difficult to see these winds at large radii from the galaxy. It's going to be impossible on the mission because the densities are so low, you'll never see it. So the absorption lines are going to be the only way. And I think, I mean, one problem that it seems like someone could calculate relatively easily is just the ionization spaces of stuff to be in. I mean, you're throwing it out at hot temperatures of a few million degrees, but you know that it's going to, I mean, cool by a factor of 100 just from the adiabatic expansion that goes out to large radii. But the density is so low that, I mean, the metals are probably not going to recombine on the dynamical time scale. So it's going to be way out of equilibrium, and I mean, those are calculations that it seems like could be done even in 1D to get a better idea of what ionization state this stuff should be at. In terms of
forget about the calculations. I mean, like observationally, you have gas, it's at a velocity, you have it in a bunch of different spots. I mean, right. That's going to help build the picture. Our models for this stuff are crappy. I think that's been demonstrated a number of times.
So to actually curve this stuff, you know, in many ionization states at once, you've got to use the respirator UV spectrum, right, to have many different elements and many different ionization states. And to do that and have several sight lines per galaxy, I mean, you basically need a UV telescope that will let you take a spectrum of magnitude 20 quasars. It's kind of the magic number. So this is, you know, kind of an 8-meter class UV telescope or something.
She might still be alive.
She might be, but the rest of us.
Anyone else have anything to say on this topic?
I mean, I guess I'll say one other way we're trying this. I mean, with the sodium outflows, I mean, some of them had very high equivalent width. So Al Shapley and Kurt Eilberger and I are playing around with the idea of trying to actually see these in absorption against background galaxies rather than background quasars. And, you know, if the absorption widths are several angstroms, we will see.
I'd like to support, follow up something that Heckman showed us earlier, just remind us. In the case of M82, the wind is hitting some dwarf galaxy, which is a gas cloud, 10 kiloparsecs away. At XMM, you can show that that blob has oxygen emission lines. So if you're slightly lucky, and well, you don't have to be terribly lucky. There's dwarf galaxies that are gas-rich all over the place. All you need is, and Tim showed us possibly another one where a wind is hitting a dwarf galaxy. But I think you can actually might see these winds when they hit the dwarf galaxies, shock them. Do an X-ray spectrum and see the metals, and you can do it. So I don't think it's crazy to look for such a thing. We already have two of them.
Well, and I think there's actually more. I mean, I showed a couple of X-ray images that Victor Sortino is working on here. And, you know, we saw an interesting correlation between where the diffuse X-rays are and where some of the extended tidal regions are. to funnel us. And perhaps one explanation is that, you know, we're seeing that besides, you know, having stars in tidal arms, there's also a gas in tidal arms. And we're seeing the X-rays where a hotter wind is actually running into this tidal gas. And we're seeing cooler X-rays.
One of the more interesting things about this Steidel-Alberger thing, I thought, was that you see this deficit of H1, but you see a continuing increase of carbon-4 as you go towards these galaxies.
Right.
So I don't think they didn't say anything about O6, but I mean, you know, I think that's a key thing, right? That's a critical thing for photo, you know, is it photoionization? It still could be, right? Antonello Maselli's stuff, so it may even be photoionization, right?
We can't match it. I mean, we basically have. I mean, we've tried pretty extreme things. I mean, it's a mystery to me. I mean, my answer is, you know, the observations are wrong. But I mean,
the new data is quite interesting on that, right?
Yeah, we tried AGN. We tried everything. It has to be really big, Artie. Is the problem? It has to be 1.5 megaparsecs. Come. You can just artificially push it out. You can't.
That's
do
just photoionization.
You have to. You have to remove all the H1 out to 1.5 co-moving megaparsec. Any hot bubble from any. Come on, one person at a time, and that's me right now. The hot bubble, if you're going to do it by hand, has to extend out to 1.5 co-moving megaparsecs.
Not with the new data, Neil. Not with the new
data. And if you take one of the wind models, like Broca runs, or like we saw Renu do, those bubbles, you take those simulations and you do the same observation, the fake observation, you come nowhere near measuring. That's what the plots that Chuck was.
See, now there was 30% of them were paired for H1,
not 100%. Still, 30% of them, there's something, you know, drastic happening, and maybe 70% there.
Yeah. The driver everywhere. 30% means it's an investment thing. And there's 30% of my side, the driver, and 30% at all, or 70% at all. So what we need to do is to drive it too.
Okay.
The problem is.
Wait,
one person at a time. Let me tell you why it's so difficult. Right. It's not just that you need to, you know, you have that projected separation. It's worse than that because there's infall on the galaxies. So even if you make some bubble around what appears to be that distance, the material from further out is falling in, and in velocity will appear on top, you know, at that distance. So that's why you have to do it. It is, but that's in the simulation.
Doesn't
right?
matter.
It's the
it's
same simulation. No, it's not 4 pi, obviously.
In the surrounding of any given galaxy in which you're trying to do the exercise, you find that the density increases, the recombination rate goes up a lot. So keeping the H1 fraction low, it's impossible.
Well, obviously nature does it. So. the old crick thing.
I don't think that's a fair thing. I mean, the observations are, it's a lot harder to turn around these observations than it is for us to be like, well, put bubbles everywhere.
Never believe observations until they're confirmed by theory.
Yeah.
This is a priest.
All right.
This is what you learn at Princeton, right?
Exactly. What Lyman Spitzer told me.
We're running out of time. I just want to go on to the last two topics together in case anyone has anything very. Remember, the last two topics, we talked about this yesterday. If anyone has anything that there is dying, some new insight. Or we haven't talked at all about any of this stuff since the first day, since it has nothing to do with the meeting.
I'd like to ask a question that we skipped over from the previous new graph, but this connects directly to this one.
Wait,
that was the sources of ionization.
Oh.
The C black holes or top-heavy IMF.
Stay on the last new graph.
Now it was my understanding. Oh, okay. There was I thought a spectacular result presented on the first day on the infrared background, where there was direct evidence that there was light that was not distributed by stars at redshifts less than 5.
Well, actually, you should go to Raphael. Right, but the question Well, we were talking about the infrared background, so the excess, I think. The J band, there is an excess over the any known galaxy that is a factor of 3 over that level. And the nice thing is that not only you can fit, or we have been able to fit that data in intensity, but also the correlation, the fluctuations that obtained from a different instrument, which is 2 mass. Plus, this is the excess is also confirmed now by a new result that is the TEV photon-photon absorption from distant blazers. You can't fit the spectra of the most distant blazer unless you have the infrared excess. So the excess is proved independently by 3 different arguments.
And it comes from very high redshift, which with the TEV blazer, yeah. I'd say.
Larger than 9. No, the TEV, the blazer is 0.15. The infrared excess has to be there, otherwise you can't fit the spectrum on the laser.
So, I mean, isn't that the best indirect evidence we have for top 3 stars? Question mark.
Well, some people would say that, I think. Well, others would not.
Let's see.
I don't know. I'm quoting Jerry Ostreicher, if true, very important. Very important.
Let me ask a corollary question then. If this is not top 3 stars, could it be, right, you know, high redshift black hole?
Zoltan's not here. He's like Mr. Black Hole at high redshift. But is anyone can anyone tell me a good argument why I should believe in that? that the universe had a lot of X-ray reionization at high redshift. Paying you
again, the man behind you.
With black holes.
Yeah, but how do you get the black hole? Why should I believe that there are
whole
bunch of
top 3 stars?
Well, I think that whatever, well, it could be, but before there is the star, right? So before you get the 100 solar mass black hole, you have the corresponding mass that has produced the photons that with which we already explained the infrared background. So we don't need black holes in addition, because that will come after the star.
I think black holes are starting to point to black holes.
Not if you have the supernova where the whole star disappears, which is what Stan was trying. Lisa, oh yeah, that'll help.
Okay, well, since this was raised provocatively, let me just continue the provocation. If we don't have these primordial black holes, then we don't have the rapid merger rate that gives Lisa the interesting signal. So would you be willing to stand up there and say Lisa won't see anything interesting?
I'll do that.
No. I'm being provocative.
Let me make clear. This is wrong. The infrared background does nothing to do. If there are top 3 stars that produce the infrared background, those top 3 stars can die as black holes.
Yes.
End up as black holes.
But
they don't have to.
The stars we need
are larger than 100 solar masses, because we don't want to overproduce metals. So these stars will go into the black holes that Pierre is using to build up the supermassive black holes. So it's conceivable.
But then those black holes do not have to radiate to do anything that we can observe today. But they can merge together to give a gravitational signal. That's hard. Well, that may be possible to see.
No, but I mean, that the only global impact that might have is some warming up of the intergalactic medium and some, you know, fine fraction of the main metal.
They don't produce metals, so they can stimulate each
How about a provocative vote? How many people think that CDM is correct on the scales that Tom is safe? Raise your hand.
If WMAP is right,
Well, WMAP has nothing to say about the scales.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, not all of it. Well, the early reality, if you want to, yeah, yeah.
If there is warm dark matter.
Right. How about who thinks that CDM isn't correct on those scales? Anyone? All right, let's hear it. I want to hear the other.
Well, I mean, the bottom line is that we know general relativity is the wrong theory of gravity, because it doesn't explain it can't be unified with quantum mechanics at the present level. So at some level that I can't tell you what it is.
The Planck scale is a lot different. He's not, at least not going down to that scale.
But don't you think that if you had the right theory of gravity, there'd be subtle differences that would be important at all scales?
Well, of course, if the dark matter particle had a bit of a...
Okay. Do you see that it'll be consistent?
Well, there are people doing experiments in the laboratory now to actually measure big G as a function of scale. Someone thinks it's interesting.
This is a dangerous place to talk about.
I know.
We don't, and it's being recorded.
On that note, okay.
Somebody should have said that earlier.
Well, why don't we thank the panel for a very illuminating discussion? And before he escapes, let's thank the organizer.
No.